We're keeping an eye on the storm in the Gulf and on the fury exposed in Charlottesville. A third person has been arrested in connection with the beating of a black man during the upheaval there, a vicious attack caught on video. And there's been criticism of the Trump administration for failing to enact a grant announced by the Obama administration to a group that rehabilitates right-wing extremists like those who attended the Charlottesville rally. The Department of Homeland Security announced the grant in January, quietly canceled it in June, and according to some former officials, it's because the department is focusing instead on Islamist terrorists in the U.S. Well, our next guest says they should broaden that focus. For instance, there's the young man known on YouTube as PewDiePie, 53 million subscribers, billions of views, a partnership with a Disney company, which they just canceled when they realized this adorable YouTube star spewed anti-Semitic and Nazi-themed content. We're going to take a broader look at the administration's policy on combating hate tomorrow. But now let's bring in Christian Picciolini, who co-founded Life After Hate, to rehabilitate haters like the one he once was. And Christian, you tell us you were recruited and easy prey, not a racist, but an Italian-American at a time, and I know it's hard for people to grasp, but at a time when it was common for Italians to be ridiculed.
You know, I came from a normal family. My parents were Italian immigrants who came to the U.S. in the mid-60s. And I didn't have a foundation of racism. There wasn't, any kind of prejudice as part of my DNA. I just didn't grow up that way. But because my parents were immigrants, they also had to work very hard, and that kept them away from home 7 days a week, 14 hours a day. So I felt very abandoned as a young boy. And, you know, they were very insulated in their community. So I didn't really understand where I belonged. I didn't know if I was Italian or American, and I was bullied because of that.
So when a guy walks up to you, an older guy who could empower you, you took the bait because you were vulnerable. And it's really not a pretty picture, as you know, Christian. I mean, it started with just a demand for some freedoms. It's interesting. We're hearing a lot of that now. You organized a cafeteria sit-in of school, demanding a white student union. But then you went on to violence, assaulting black students, a black security guard.
You know, it started out as him boosting my pride. He saw me as this vulnerable young kid who really wanted to matter. He would tell me things like, your ancestors are great warriors and philosophers and artists. But then, you know, the language would change over time to say, you know, that your pride, somebody wants to take that away from you. And then, of course, it would ramp up to, we have to eliminate the enemy that's trying to take that away from you. So during those 8 years, there were levels of violence that even today, remembering them are troubling to me. There was a lot of recruitment of young people, and certainly I changed the lives of many people, who either went to prison or ended up dead. Not to mention, the victims of our violence. It was an 8-year period where I really hated myself, and I was trying to project that hatred onto other people so I didn't have to feel my own pain.
Well, in 1994, you opened a record store, Chaos Records, devoted to white power music. But then what happened?
Well, I certainly opened the store with the intention of selling white power music, and it was very successful. It was 75% of my revenue. But I also wanted to be a good business person, and I decided to expand and sell punk rock music and hip hop music and heavy metal. And what happened next, I never would have expected. The people who came in to buy that music, who were African American or Jewish or gay, instead of attacking me, they came in and showed me compassion. In fact, they showed me compassion when I least deserved it, and they were the people that I likely least deserved it from. And that allowed me to humanize them, because in my head, I had this picture of a monster or a parasite who was attacking me, when in reality, I had never had a meaningful interaction with the people that I thought I hated, and this allowed me to bridge that gap.
And there came the transformation. You became embarrassed, realized what you were doing, closed the store. I want to skip forward to you form Life After Hate and see what? I mean, what kind of need are you seeing? Are there really that many people that there needs to be an organization to help people get out of white supremacist groups?
When we first launched the organization in 2011, initially it wasn't an intervention service. We were just speaking publicly and educating people and doing trainings. But we very rapidly saw the need of people who were reaching out to us unsolicited that wanted help disengaging from that movement. When we first started, we were getting about 2 requests a week. And I can tell you, Robin, after the election in 2016, we started to receive about 4 or 5 requests a day.
And this is for people wanting you to go intervene and try to get their loved ones out?
That's correct. Sometimes people themselves will reach out to us if they feel stuck and can't leave, because it's so difficult to leave. And there were so many people that I knew in the movement who had questioned their ideology but couldn't abandon their identity, their community, and their sense of purpose, because that's all they had known. To start that process is very difficult, and we wanted to be able to help folks do that.
Look, your funding to do all this has been rescinded from the government, the $400,000. We know you crowdsourced and got a lot of support, but maybe half of what the funding would have been. Many of those studying this say it's because the White House is focused almost exclusively on possible Islamist-backed hate in the U.S. as opposed to white supremacy. And others point to the fact that you were critical of President Trump. You tweeted out one of the tweets, "Every day that passes with @RealDonaldTrump in office will take America 100 years to repair." Did you dig your own grave there, or, you know, what do you think of this?
You know, I honestly, Robin, I don't know. We were never given a reason. I did absolutely make some tweets that were critical. You know, I believe in speaking my mind and speaking against injustice, and a lot of the rhetoric and policy that's coming out of this administration mimics a lot of what we used to say 30 years ago. It's very anti-immigrant. It's xenophobic. It's bigoted. And certainly the white nationalists and the alt-right and the white supremacists right now are rejoicing over the fact that it appears that the administration is supporting their efforts based on not necessarily what they say, but what they don't say.
Look, Faiza Patel, who's with New York University School of Law, says that there are definitely problems with the Trump administration in this arena. But even the Obama administration was focused too much on potential extremism in Muslim communities and not looking at what you are looking at. And I just, you know, if you could share what you're seeing. How right in front of us is some of this recruitment?
It's very pervasive, Robin. You know, the internet has allowed the movement to, and not just the white nationalist movement, but also extremist groups like ISIS, to really ramp up their recruitment efforts online. You know, whereas in my day, it was very face-to-face, very personal. You know, we had to scope out vulnerable people at punk rock shows and skate parks to recruit them. Now, you know, people can go online if they feel marginalized. They can create whatever identity they want. They have a built-in community on the internet. And the purpose is given to them by these very savvy, very, you know, fashionable recruiters who don't look like we used to. You know, we were skinheads. And in our day, you know, there was KKK, and you could easily identify a white supremacist walking down the street. Nowadays, because of a concerted strategy on our part 30 years ago, when we recognized that the average American white racist was put off by our edginess, we decided to tone it down, to grow our hair out and to wear suits instead of boots, to go to college campuses and recruit, to get jobs in law enforcement and join the military to get training and to even run for office.
Really? That was like was a strategy?
It was a strategy to blend in. We called it leaderless resistance. And, if you join a group, it's easier for law enforcement to take you down, so don't do that. And blend in. Look like your neighbor, your dentist, your attorney, your teacher, your nurse, and take the message of the ideology and polish it just to make it a little bit more palatable, a little bit easier to swallow for the average American white racist, and recruit that way, because we recognize that if we wanted them, we needed to be like them, sound like them, and look like them. And here we are 30 years later. And in fact, that's exactly what's happening.
Do you have people like parents who might be realizing, oh, my kid was wearing khakis and a white shirt, but it turns out he's in Vanguard America, which was the group that the driver in Charlottesville was in?
Unfortunately, I get emails every day and phone calls every day from parents who are terrified that their son or daughter is potentially the next Dylann Roof or the next driver of that car in Charlottesville. And it's terrifying to know that these young, vulnerable people who really want to make a difference, who are looking to belong, are being manipulated to join this movement for the sake of belonging. And certainly that was the case for me too. I wasn't a racist when I was first recruited. I joined because I wanted to be a part of something. And I think now with the violence that we're seeing on, you know, happening at these rallies, you know, there's never been anybody, I think, in the history of the world who's changed their racist views by being punched. And this is, may not be a popular thought, but we need to understand that they're human beings who are broken. And eventually, it's impossible to reconcile the prejudice once you yourself have witnessed, you know, the people that you think that you hate are not the monsters that you've created in your head.
Christian Picciolini, a former skinhead, now author and co-founder of the group Life After Hate. Christian, thank you. Best to you.
Robin, thank you very much.
And by the way, we reached out to the Department of Homeland Security for comment on the cancellation of grants to what the New York Times says was of many groups fighting white supremacy. Officials told us the cancellations weren't exclusively of groups focused on white supremacy and that the administration remains committed to combating all forms of violent extremism. Well, we'll link you to Christian's GoFundMe site and would love to hear your thoughts on his description of the new khaki-clad hate movement, maybe coming to a college near you. That's welcome at hereandnow.org.